AT&T and Time Warner are reacting to news that the Justice Department is trying to block an $85 billion merger of the two companies. AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson spoke to reporters last night.
The government contends that AT&T, with 25 million TV customers, and Turner, with a single-digit share of all media watched, will have unlawful market power. This defies logic, and it is unprecedented.
Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. And Ali, we heard CEO of AT&T there calling this move by the Justice Department unprecedented. Is he right about that?
Well, it depends. Some years ago, the Justice Department stopped the merger of Office Depot and Staples because they thought those two companies would have too much control in the office supply market. And a lot of people thought that was silly, but at least it allows you to understand how the Justice Department is supposed to think about these things. The difficulty is that this isn't like Office Depot and Staples. It's not like two separate chains that sell the same thing. This is a lot more like my parent company, Comcast and NBC Universal, a distribution company buying a content company. It's called a vertical integration as opposed to horizontal integration. So the Justice Department's concerns in this particular case don't seem to be correct. The idea that the Justice Department has concerns and that mergers can sometimes be bad for customers is entirely valid. But of all the reasons not to like this merger, the Justice Department seems to be taking a different tack.
And just to be clear, the point is that AT&T is saying it does not directly compete with Time Warner, and a deal between two companies like that hasn't been blocked in many decades. But
yes.
Yeah.
The difference, of course, is that these companies are all merging into each other's space a little bit anyway. And I mean, because all of the distribution companies now have a little bit of content and the content companies have a little bit of distribution. But the point is really to emulate the Comcast NBC model, where there's a lot of content and through the Comcast side, a lot of ability to get that content to people's phones or their TV. So it's a sensible merger. There's a really valid discussion to be had about how it's going to affect consumers and whether prices will go up and things like that. But this does have a bit of a feel of being a little bit political because the president has indicated that he thinks there's too much concentration in media and that he would, you know, he said this before he became president, that he would take a role in that. Again, if you're concerned about too much concentration in media, which is a good concern to have, there are other mergers underway right now that the president hasn't spoken about, including the Sinclair Media.
Well, yeah, and you know, let's get into that politics thing that you just mentioned there. Time Warner, of course, owns CNN. President Trump has been very clear he does not like that news network. And people have said during the course of this decision-making process that the administration may be retaliating. And AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson brought that up last night.
We cannot and we will not be party to any agreement that would even give the perception of compromising the First Amendment protections of the press. So any agreement that results in us forfeiting control of CNN, whether directly or indirectly, is a non-starter.
What are the concerns about a potential conflict of interest?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the Justice Department seems to have told AT&T two things. They can either divest of DirecTV, and when that merger was done, that's what you call a horizontal merger, right? That's a distributor of a distributor and a distributor getting together. Or they can divest of Turner Broadcasting, of which CNN is a part. Well, those two things don't make sense. You can sort of say, oh, I see if you have DirecTV, you've got too much distribution, but this deal doesn't add any more distribution. So it almost gave them a weird choice, knowing that AT&T wouldn't divest of DirecTV in order to buy Time Warner, that it would cause them to give up CNN. Now, the Justice Department asked about it, said, well, it's not CNN, it's Turner Broadcasting. But that's CNN and a couple of other channels, which, as Randall Stephenson says, have single digits of share in the market. So there is yet to be a legal argument as to why this makes sense. Now, obviously, they're suing AT&T, so we'll at some point hear a legal argument if AT&T sees this all the way through to court. But as of now, most experts are saying there isn't a concern with respect to that. Again, there's always a concern about companies getting bigger because they have more control over the consumer, but that does not seem to be what the government is arguing here. So it feels a little political at the moment.
Well, what is the sense? Bottom line, if you can give it, what does it mean for consumers?
Well, any company that gets bigger achieves greater scale and greater control over the market. So there is some concern by some experts that prices could get higher. More importantly, because of the combination of the net neutrality conversation that I know you guys were just having, Could it be that companies that own content can favor that content to their suppliers? So if you're a Time Warner AT&T subscriber, is it going to be easier for you to watch CNN than it is to watch Fox, or to get Time Warner content easier than other content? So that's a bigger discussion about net neutrality, but ultimately very hard to tell what the disruptive part to consumers will be if this deal were to go through. It'd be, I'm interested to hear what the Justice Department has to say about it.
All right, Ali Velshi, MSNBC, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
As Black Friday and Cyber Monday approach, the formal start of the holiday shopping season, the National Retail Federation looked at consumer confidence and concluded holiday sales will increase about 4% from last year. So do more sales mean better seasonal jobs and higher wages for workers? Andy Challenger is vice president of Challenger Gray and Christmas. He joins us from Chicago. Andy, is there really someone at your firm named Christmas?
Long ago partner, no longer involved. Now it is just Challengers now.
Well, it's a nice touch. So how is the holiday hiring looking this year for the seasonal workers?
We think holiday hiring is going to be fairly strong. We always see a really big spike in employment in retail during the last couple months of the year. It does look like this spike might be slightly down from what we've seen last year or the last couple years. But overall, hiring in the sector has actually been pretty good despite some major changes in the retail sector.
And talk about the role of Amazon in seasonal hiring, but also how that spreads out to everyone else when Amazon kicks in, how that affects everyone else.
Yeah, well, e-commerce in general has transformed the industry. It's going through a major pivot right now. We saw over 6,000 brick-and-mortar store closures in retail just this year. But at the same time, the retail sector's been the number one hirer of all industries across the country because they're shifting operations from these kind of front-of-the-store brick-and-mortar jobs of sales associates, cashiers, and they're doing a lot of hiring in the back, in warehousing, in shipping and handling.
Right. Amazon is going to be hiring 120,000 seasonal workers this year. But when Amazon is doing more, that means UPS does and FedEx does. We're reading UPS will hire 95,000 temporary employees, FedEx 50,000. And as you said, a lot of these new jobs are, you know, related to online sales.
Exactly. And all the big box retailers are competing for that same diminishing pool of labor to serve these temporary job roles during the holidays. Unemployment across the country is about 4.1%. It means there's job shortages in a lot of metro areas. And so all these retailers are now competing with Amazon, with UPS and FedEx to get people in the door ahead of the holiday season.
Yeah. A couple other numbers. Target hiring 100,000. Macy's hiring 18,000 to work at fulfillment centers, because you go to Macy's, you hardly ever see a salesperson there. But there are still things we're reading that people want to go to a store for. They don't want to shop online, like makeup.
Absolutely. Those jobs are not going away, but they are being diminished in certain areas with store closures. People with great customer service, sales associates that have worked the makeup displays at Macy's for every holiday for years, you know, don't necessarily have the same skills that Macy's needs in the warehouse and in the fulfillment centers.
Right. But how often do these seasonal jobs become real jobs? We were reporting earlier in the year that this is a year when they might translate into full-time jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. We expect this year, more than ever, employers are going to be hanging on to the employees that they hired during the holiday season because employment's so low. The cost of hiring employees, getting them trained before the season, and then just to let them go is too expensive right now to see as much turnover as we've seen in the past couple of years.
Is it too late to sign up for a seasonal job?
The hiring has been moving earlier and earlier in the season. It's not quite too late, but most employers want to have people trained before Black Friday. So a lot of those jobs are gone. But again, there's a ton of turnover within retail in particular. It's one of the highest turnover industries. So if you've tried to go get a job and weren't able to, smart to go back again a couple weeks later and try, because those jobs often reopen.
And what does that mean for those people? When might they see benefits? When might they see what comes with a full-time job?
Yeah, those benefits aren't usually included in temporary positions, although wages are slowly on the rise for these temporary holiday positions. Benefits are not usually included. But for a lot of people, this is a really good opportunity to get in the door of these retailers. In some ways, feels like a 2-3 month even interview where you're being tested in some ways. But if you get to the other side, often full-time jobs can be just around the corner.
Oh, that's, see it as a 2-3 month interview. Excellent. Andy Challenger, Vice President of Challenger Gray and Christmas. Andy, thank you.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Are you dreading Thursday, too? Nearly 60% of people surveyed by an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll are. They say they don't want their family members to pass along their political opinions while passing the turkey on Thanksgiving. On the other hand, 31% say they are eager to talk about the latest news with their family and friends. 11% say, I'm unsure. So what do teenagers say? Youth Radio asked three teens how adults misbehave at their tables and how they deal with it.
More than half of the people that normally sit at my dinner table are homophobic, which is a problem because I'm gay before I came out to my family. And my aunt was like, why would we even want to support gay marriage? Like, it doesn't matter anyway. They're all going to hell. And then, like, couldn't really say anything because I hadn't come out at the time. And so then the following year, I did end up coming out. And now I probably would address it.
I made, like, a kind of a off-the-cuff comment about, like, you can't just ban Mexicans. My uncle's girlfriend quickly responded with, well, they're bringing over their rapists. And I was like, wait, I'm talking politics at a family thing. Like, there's no way this is going to end well.
I don't have any necessarily, like, blatantly, like, racist or, like, bigoted family members. They can say some definitely out-of-pocket stuff. If my grandpa, like, goes on his long rant about why we have to, like, defeat capitalism, I just generally, like, try and interrupt him. And I'm like, well, what are you doing about it?
When I have a family member say something really out of pocket, I typically don't respond. It's just not worth it to kind of, like, get into the fight because I have to rely on my family to kind of pay for my education.
Whenever I'm at a gathering that I don't want to be at, I just remember I never eat this well when I'm by myself because I can only cook box mac and cheese.
Make sure you have your person with you, and you can look at each other and talk to each other, and you can be like, did this person really just say this?
Weigh the pros and cons. It's like, what can I get out of telling you off, and what can I lose? If you've got nothing to lose, just make sure you have your, like, car keys or bus ticket in hand. Like, go for it.
All right, the teenage perspective from Malia Disney, Robert Medina Fisher, and Charlie Stipe. Their story was produced by Youth Radio.
So Thursday is Thanksgiving. The following day, that insane shopping day, Black Friday, 160 million Americans are expected to take advantage of the sales. But how many will pause to reflect on the real federal holiday this coming Friday? Yep, I will give you another second to think of what that is. Okay, there is a good chance you don't know that the day after Thanksgiving is National Native American Heritage Day, signed into law by President George W. Bush in 2008, meant to honor Native Americans and their contributions to this country. But many Native Americans think the effort has fallen flat. Simon Moya Smith is a journalist and a citizen of the Oglala Lakota Tribal Nation. He's written about National Native American Day for the Indian Country Today Media Network, and in a CNN column titled, It's Time to Pick a New Native American Heritage Day. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Simon, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you feel so strongly? Day after Thanksgiving, but wrong day to celebrate Indigenous people.
Right, yeah. I mean, Native American Heritage Day should be a day when the nation takes time to recognize our contributions, our sacrifices, what happened to Indigenous people, what's still happening to Indigenous people. Instead, Native American Heritage Day falls on Black Friday, a day of excess and gluttony and greed and aggressive capitalism. And that's extremely in poor taste.
You also say it's antithetical to Native American values.
It is, yeah, because when you look at our values as Indigenous people, it's not materialistic because we're not materialistic. As indigenous people, especially if you look at what happened at Standing Rock, we say honor the water, honor the earth, honor the people. And on this specific day, it's the complete opposite of what we teach our youth and what was taught to us and what we value. And we value life. We value the earth. We value the water, not material possessions.
Well, so what kind of, you know, what day would you prefer?
Frankly, I would say any day where students are in class.
Yeah.
Because on Black Friday, students aren't in class. And then you have to look at it. This day, Native American Heritage Day, falls after a holiday that omits the murder and mutilation of natives. And that's even more difficult to stomach for me. It's nobody's recognizing that there was murder and there was mutilation of indigenous peoples on this holiday known as Thanksgiving. But for indigenous people, that day is known as Unthanksgiving or the Day of Mourning, the National Day of Mourning.
Right.
Because we mourn the millions of indigenous people who died as a result of aggressive settler colonialism.
We'll talk a little bit about that because this started in New England with the New England tribes, this National Day of Mourning as opposed to Thanksgiving. In the first speech that an Indian leader attempted to make on the first National Day of Mourning, he wanted to tell some of those truths, you know, that the pilgrims, for instance, opened Indian graves, took the Indians' corn.
And ate the flesh. That needs to be known. I mean, I think that's what people miss here is that just look at the language we've agreed upon, pilgrim, settler. No, those were invaders. They invaded our territory. They invaded our land that we've been here since time immemorial. So these invaders who encroached in our territory were so focused on finding gold that they didn't spend the time to dig crops. And so when they got here, what they did was they didn't just steal things from the grave. They weren't just grave robbers. What they were cannibals. They ate the flesh because they needed to eat something. So this is part of the narrative that it's excluded. And this narrative is just way too myth-made, way too whitewashed. And then again, after the holiday, Native American Heritage Day is Black Friday. And I don't imagine people are turning around saying, hey, yeah, I'm going to get this big screen TV, you know, it's flat screen TV. And by the way, happy Native American Heritage Day.
Well, look, staying though around Thanksgiving, what about reminding people to add an element of thanks because the early settlers would never have survived without the Indians?
Sure, then call it Thanks the Native. Do that, you know, give it a different name. Yeah, it's like Thanksgiving. Again, we're so excluded from the American conversation across the board that I think this should really be, if you're going to have a holiday that you're saying that natives helped, and it's true, we did. Without us, they would have starved. But then change the name.
Yeah.
Make it Thanks to Native Americans. Because then people have to ask the question, why are we thanking them? Well, because there wouldn't be the pilgrim, quote-unquote, pilgrim settlement without the indigenous people taking pity on these people. We'll teach you how to till the soil. Just stop what you're doing. Again, it's just an omission of what really happened.
Look, right now, Friday, Black Friday, still is Native American Appreciation Day. So what if somebody's saying, I'm with you, I'd just as soon not go to the mall, what should they do?
It's really difficult when it's on that Black Friday for you basically missed a lot because November is Native American Heritage Month. In most cities, you can find an American Indian Community House. That's here in New York. There's the Denver Indian Center. The universities, Yale, Columbia, all the way in Los Angeles, you have university student groups that have lessons. You can come and see what a powwow is. A powwow isn't when you and your colleagues go into the break room and have a meeting. That's not a powwow. A powwow is where we get together as indigenous peoples and celebrate our culture, our food, our cuisine, our regalia, our traditional ways. And that's the problem. I mean, I want people to recognize the indigenous people of today that we're doctors, lawyers, professors. We're not this stereotypical image that's perpetuated in media. But by the time Native American Heritage Day comes around, you've missed a whole month of lessons and opportunities to introduce yourself to the indigenous person of the 21st century, who lives on a res or doesn't live on a res, has short hair or has long hair, is traditional, is Christian, things like that. That's what people miss. So on that day, you're just kind of hoping that they follow us on social media, because on that day as well, we're trying to dispel all the false stereotypes of who we are and what happened.
Well, Simon, we're going to link people up as much as we can, links that you've mentioned and to stories that we've done. I'm betting there are people craving some direction for next Friday. Do I even wish you a happy Native American Heritage Day?
You can. You can say happy Native American Heritage Month. because it's still the month, right?
In fact, when you speak about drawing attention to some of the current problems, you guys have plans for Thanksgiving.
We do. We do. On the, what's again, we call the National Day of Mourning or Un-Thanksgiving, we're going to be outside the FedEx Field in Maryland when the Washington football team plays on the holiday known as Thanksgiving. And the reason we're doing that is because the CDC just came out and said that Native Americans are more likely to die at the hands of police than any other demographic. The name of the team means proof of Indian kill. The holiday, Thanksgiving, omits the murder and mutilation of natives. Football players are taking a knee against systemic oppression and police brutality. A Native American, 14-year-old Native American boy was just shot and killed by a deputy sheriff in Wisconsin. So it's a confluence that brings us back to the issue of murdered and mutilated Indians. And the fact that we're not recognizing that is egregious. So we're going to be right outside there and we're going to be protesting. But it's also to recognize justice for natives. We want justice for natives. We want people to recognize that we are still here. And they can't play on a holiday that omits the murder mutilation of natives. And this team name has been proven to harm the mental health and stability of kids. So this needs to stop. And that's where we'll be on Thanksgiving.
Well, I'm going to say, Simon, you don't want to say it. The name that you're referring to that means...
It means scalp, dead Indians.
Is Redskins. Mm-hmm. Simon, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Oglala Lakota journalist Simon Moya-Smith. Simon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Simon mentioned European settlers cannibalizing Native American graves. Now, this was not in Plymouth, Massachusetts, but in Jamestown, Virginia, during what historians refer to as the Starving Time, 1609-10, when the settlers resorted to cannibalizing, digging up their own graves. That they also cannibalized Native American graves is a claim made by sociologist James Lowen in his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. So enjoy Thanksgiving, because it had a rough start.
Jubilation in the Zimbabwean parliament today when it was announced that after 37 years in power, President Robert Mugabe had resigned. Impeachment proceedings had just started against Mugabe after house arrest and street protests had failed to force him from office. Camilla Mills is a Zimbabwean and a reporter for the BBC. And Camilla, we just heard lawmakers erupt there when they heard this news. What happened?
As you say, so impeachment proceedings were just beginning when the Speaker of the Parliament said that Mr. Mugabe had resigned in the form of a letter to Parliament. Everyone had been anticipating him to resign on Sunday night, and when he didn't in his televised speech, I think there was a real disappointment throughout the country. And everyone has just been on tenterhooks waiting to see what's going to happen, if he would resign, if the impeachment process would go forward. And if it had, I mean, people were concerned that it may take days, weeks, or even months. Right. So there's been this real kind of tense atmosphere in Zimbabwe and across the world, just waiting with bated breath.
All of this got started, of course, when Mugabe fired his vice president, who has finally broken his silence. What is the former vice president saying today, and what will his role be going forward?
Well, as you say, Mr. Mnangagwa, he was fired 2 weeks ago. And as it stands, he is now the leader of the ZANU-PF party, which is the ruling party. So in a few weeks' time, in December, we'll have the party congress. And that is where we expect that he will make his first appearance and lay out what's going to happen, whether he will be the interim president. That is yet to be announced, but he is leader of the ZANU-PF party. And, you know, Grace Mugabe has been expelled. That's Mr. Mugabe's wife, has been expelled from the party. And she had been tipped to be the next vice president. And that's what many say ignited this entire situation that we're in now.
Parliament, of course, we said reacted very jubilantly to the news. What about people across the country? How are they responding to this?
Well, there's this complete euphoria. I mean, I've been watching scenes of it. I've been getting quite emotional watching it. The news channels have been crossing to the streets where there is just people running through the streets, honking the horns on their cars. And these are scenes that we have not seen in Zimbabwe because of fear. There have even been laws within the country about gatherings larger than the number five. So for instance, when I got married a few years ago, for my wedding, I had to get a license from the police to prove to them that I was not holding a political gathering. And at 1 a.m., I had the police outside my gate saying, your license is up. What's happening? Is this a political gathering? And people had to leave. So, you know, to have people in the streets cheering and hugging the army, it's unprecedented.
What about the legacy of Robert Mugabe? Here's a man who was called the father of the country, the only president that Zimbabwe had seen since it was formed in 1980. But this is such an unglamorous end for him.
Well, yes. I mean, he's the only president I've ever known. I was born post-independence, and that's the case for many people. So, you know, for someone who was considered to be a hero and the face of liberation in the 1980s, for him to leave this way, yes, it is undignified, but it has been said that this is a more dignified exit than had he been impeached and had he been forced out of government.
That's Camilla Mills, a reporter for the BBC in London. Camilla, thank you so much for helping us out.
Thank you so much for having me.
The House Republican tax bill that was passed last week could have significant consequences for higher education. The Senate plans to vote on its tax bill after Thanksgiving. Then the two versions will have to be reconciled. But colleges and universities are already concerned about aspects of the House bill. Even before that version passed, Ted Mitchell, president of the American Council on Education, said that provisions in the House bill would discourage participation in post-secondary education college and make college more expensive. This is not in America's national interest, he wrote. Well, Sharon Gaber agrees. She's president of the University of Toledo, a public research university in Ohio. We reached her by Skype. President Gaber, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And you wrote a letter to your Congresswoman, Marcy Kaptur, in fact, your whole congressional delegation, about the House bill with concerns about some of those provisions. Start with the effect on grad students.
For us, we have a large number of graduate and professional students. Almost 40% of our student population is graduate or professional. So the impact of having a tuition waiver potentially taxed would be devastating.
Well, talk about how it works. I mean, we've been throwing around some terms, but a tuition waiver means literally that people can come and work as grad students, but doing hands-on research, and they don't pay tuition.
Correct. They are typically a teaching assistant or a research assistant. For us, we bring in a large number of graduate students, and this is typical across the country. They receive a graduate assistantship at an institution like Toledo. That could be, for an in-state student, a $10,000 tuition waiver, or for an out-of-state student, almost a $20,000 tuition waiver. If they're taxed on that, they maybe don't have resources coming in to help offset those taxes.
Right, because they're working as grad students. Now, just to be clear, are they being paid for that work as grad students?
Oh, typically, yes. They're getting a stipend as well as the tuition waiver. So a stipend may be, at an institution like the University of Toledo, that may be anywhere between $10,000 and $15,000 a year. In some disciplines, it may be higher. But if you're earning, say, $12,000 a year as your stipend, and you're being taxed on your tuition waiver of $20,000 a year, we have a little imbalance there, and there's probably an argument why it's not in the best interest of our grad students. Either, you know, then they think about, am I going to be able to come and afford to do this? Or what does that look like for me? Or do I have to take a second job to pay that tax?
Well, let's be even clearer. The Chronicle of Higher Education has spoken to some students. There was a doctoral student in molecular biophysics and biochemistry at Yale. She was receiving an annual stipend a little more than $35,000. That's high. Her tuition waiver was about $41,000, so she didn't have to pay tuition. She's doing this work, 8-hour workday or whatever, taking in $35,000. But she said her taxes would go from $3,000 to $10,000. So she'd have to pay $10,000 in taxes on that $35,000 that she was making to literally work at the school. And then she felt she couldn't live, you know, at Yale in that area for $20,000 a year.
Right. And for us, it's certainly a similar situation. Our tuition and our stipends are not as high as Yale's. Mm-hmm. About a third of our students are first-generation college students. The majority of our students are Ohio, Michigan, Indiana students. So your point is exactly correct. We want these students to be able to come to the University of Toledo, and it's certainly going to help our regional economy. But then thinking about what does that look like with a new tax burden that these students hadn't had, and are they taking another job on top of this? You know, and is that even feasible?
Well, but you know, the argument on the Republican side with these tax plans is, and by the way, the Senate plan doesn't have the same proposals that the House does that would affect education the way these do. But the argument is that they feel that their plans overall will bring more money to the middle class so that they won't need these stipends and they'll be able to pay the taxes on them if they do need them.
What I wanted to do as the president of the university was really raise the concern and point out that this could be a stumbling block for some of our graduate students, and we want to ensure that we keep our research program active. At our institution, we're very active, obviously, in Lake Erie's algal bloom research, and for this region, it is important to ensure that drinking water is clean and safe, and so we continue to do that, and without our graduate students, that would certainly be detrimental to continuing that research and ensuring Toledo and other areas have that clean drinking water.
Well, the College and University Professional Association for Human Resources says that about 60% of the grad students who get these tuition waivers are studying for degrees in science and technology. Do you think that young people will not choose this path if there's that tax on them?
My concern is at an institution like the University of Toledo, we do have first-generation students. We have students who might not have the opportunity to go to schools with a higher endowment that could help pay them. What may happen at wealthier institutions is that their stipends may increase to compensate and offset for the tax on the waivers, should that go through. We don't have that luxury.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about student loans. In 2017, 44 million Americans have student loans totaling over $1.45 trillion. Big issue. Currently, low and middle income Americans can deduct up to $2,500 a year in student loan interest. This would go away under the House tax bill. Now, that's going to affect people who already have the loans, but do you think it will have a chilling effect on people taking them out and going to your school?
I think that's a possibility, and I certainly think that our school, we work very hard to maintain its affordability. We recognize who our student population is, and we work hard at that. And certainly we have students who have unmet need that take out loans. I think anytime you create one more obstacle, it becomes difficult for students to want to do that. So it's just one more hurdle. Yeah. In the state of Ohio, the governor's pointed out there's a talent gap, and he's put out as a goal that 65% of Ohioans should have a degree or other post-secondary credential by 2025. Well, that's hard to do as we put up more hurdles.
By the way, the House tax overhaul also includes a tax on employer-provided educational assistance. Yours from the school is a stipend. There's been a suggestion that you just turn that stipend into a scholarship and it wouldn't be taxed.
And I think certainly we will have to look at that. Now, as you say that, there are states and institutions that I've worked at previously, states will limit the amount of scholarships that state institutions are allowed to provide.
Look, you know, there's been a bit of a pushback against schools of higher education, the sense that they're way too expensive. There was a phase a few years ago where suddenly schools were building climbing walls and huge gyms and all sorts of add-ons to attract students, and the prices jacked up. There are some people who feel that schools shouldn't get as much help. There are huge endowments at schools, and that in fact, instead of these tax breaks, the school should just cost less. Your thoughts?
And certainly I hear the same conversations that you do, which is why we continue to focus on affordability. In the state of Ohio, we have had tuition freezes for all public institutions for the past 3 years. And in fact, next year we'll have it also. We are currently the second lowest tuition rate of all research universities in the state. We've got a modest endowment. We certainly provide a fair amount of scholarships, and we also recognize that it is important here to help our students to be able to continue to help this regional economy, which has gone through really a shift in terms of being an industrial-based economy. We still have strong industry and manufacturing, but we also have burgeoning healthcare and innovation. So, you know, again, we have to continue to have an educated workforce to be able to assist the economy in its growth.
Sharon Gaber, president of the University of Toledo, and as we just heard, a Toledo booster. President Gaber, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. Will you be able to do grad student work without the tax break? Your thoughts on having to pay some taxes on a stipend? Let us know, hereandnow.org. Perhaps you are already against wearing fur. After all, animals are slaughtered so that you can. But you find faux fur a little, shall we say, lacking. It's not natural, and you can feel it, sometimes smell it. Our next guest noted those failings as well. Kim Cantor is a longtime fashion magazine editor, stylist, creative director, and a longtime fur collector who's had a change of heart. She's come out with a new line called House of Fluff. It's billed as the first environmentally friendly faux fur lifestyle brand based in New York. And she joins us now from the NPR studios there. Kim, welcome.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Good. So tell me, first of all, about your fur collection. You were a fur lover.
I was a fur lover. You know, many years ago, had loved the glamour of fur. I grew up with fur being a very glamorous item of that was very desirable on a luxury level.
Right. You had 26.
I had 26. I'd also worked for a fur company.
Oh, well, there. Well,
that
but,
helped.
But, you know, fur is, it's warm. There's a feel to it. This is Mother Nature at work here. And so it feels so real. I mean, it can be lovely.
Well, it's not really lovely. Mm-hmm. It's not really lovely when you understand where it comes from and how it's made. Mm. And that became more and more the issue for me. Mm. Why sacrifice my ethics for beauty? Mm. I mean, it is beautiful, but it's not beautifully made.
Yeah. No, it's horribly made. The animals suffer terribly, and it's horrible. So you sold all those furs to start this company?
Yes. You know, I've been in fashion for a long time. I wanted to make a new brand. I was interested in what fashion means to the next generation. And I realized that I had felt increasingly uncomfortable in my own furs. Mm. And since there was really no reason to make another white shirt or black skirt, I realized if I felt that way, there are probably a lot of other young women that also feel that way.
Right.
And with no alternative, we launched House of Fluff.
House of Fluff. So what was wrong? I mean, look, I'm looking at an Old Navy pink faux fur little jacket. It's like $40 or something like that. And, you know, I've got my eye on that. What's the difference between your faux fur and, you know, the Gap has faux fur now? It's just there's these great coats coming out. What's the difference between theirs and yours?
I mean, I haven't seen the coats, but I believe that they're cruelty-free products. But a lot of those fur products are made in China, and they're made in countries that don't have regulation for the factories. So they can be polluting the environment in very terrible ways. And a lot of those furs have a lot of different chemical compounds in them, and they actually don't feel very good. Mm. They're also made in factories that may not pay the workers a fair wage.
Okay.
So ours, the House of Fluff faux fur, comes from a mill in Italy, which is completely regulated. So although the fur itself does have some polyester in it, it's made and it doesn't kill any animals. It's cruelty-free. Same with the vegan leather that we use. It's at least coming from a country that is very careful about a certain protocol that factories, as far as polluting, must follow. We also make our product here in New York City in a fair trade factory.
Well, talk more about the chemicals that you can feel them in some faux fur.
Yes. There's also a sheen that you see on some of the less expensive furs. But, I mean, the real issue is you have to start thinking, you know, if something can cost $40 or $20, you know, at a Zara or an H&M, where was that made? Who the person that made that, what were they being paid? Mm-hmm. And I think the ethics really go beyond just killing animals. You have to look at the human experience.
Well, the human experience making it and using it. You use natural dyes. Recycle everything that's plastic, the hangers, the hang tags.
Everything. Yeah. I mean, our goal is to have as low a carbon footprint as possible and to be a zero waste company. So we even take the scraps from the factory floor and craft them into little collectible characters we call scrappies. And we also put the scrappy faces on organic cotton sweatshirts. So we try to use as much as possible. I mean, we even make our own garment bags out of cotton muslin and are looking to do that with a women's co-op in Costa Rica.
Well, and because of that, yours are a little pricier than the chain stores, $200 to $1,400. But that's far less than a real fur. By the way, how much were your furs worth? You had 26?
You know, the retail value of the furs, some of them were very high. I mean, I had a sable coat that was, I think, a retail value of $45,000. You know, some of them were vintage and very priceless and very good condition. You know, I didn't get near what the retail price would be. I probably got a dime on the dollar.
Wait, do you miss them?
Not anymore. You know, it's horrible to wear a vintage monkey fur, you know, horrible. But we make a fur that's long-haired that we call Yeti that's as glamorous in a cape. And, you know, there's no distinction between beauty and morality at House of Fluff.
Kim Cantor is the founder of House of Fluff, a faux fur lifestyle brand. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. Kim, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that was pretty much a commercial, but whatever. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter Rodow. This is Here and Now.